everybody. This is Mike Burke. I'm a corporate partner in the Washington, D.C. office of Arnold, Gold & Gregory, and welcome to another episode of AGG Talks Cross-Border Business. This episode, I'm joined by my partner, Anuj Desai, who is an expert in all things intellectual property, especially how non-U.S. companies can protect their IP in the U.S. and both build and protect brands. So Anuj, great to have you. If you could introduce yourself.
Happy to, Mike. Thanks for letting me be part of this podcast series. Anuj Desai, I am a member of the firm's intellectual property group and head of our trademarks team. Been dealing with cross-border clients, transactions, market entry, both into the US and into other countries, and all of the IP questions that come up with that. So I think it'd be interesting and fun to kind of hit some questions and topics on things that companies in this space deal with pretty often.
And the thing is, you said companies in this space, this is sort of a universal thing that, you know, anytime a company has a trademark, for example, that they need to protect. But I'll start off with this one question. You know, when we deal with companies coming over here, the corporate stuff is pretty straightforward. The formation stuff is fairly straightforward. And then you pivot the conversation to, well, what are you doing about, you know, identifying, protecting your intellectual property? And the usual answer we get is, oh yeah, we've got that covered. And then 2 years later, you find they didn't have it covered. What do you think are some of the non-US company should do on the IP side as they're preparing to expand here?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's a great point. And often when companies are eager to just kind of get going, get that revenue in the door, you're right. A lot of these sort of things are just considered nice to have, but not really needed. And then they kind of put it on the back burner, and then the back burner is just, it's sitting there.
Right.
But, you know, the reality is once you go through the corporate formalities, opening a subsidiary in the U.S., things like that, folks tend to forget that doing business in the U.S. or any country, really, is going to involve an IP transaction or dispute at some point. There's just no getting around it. And so doing your homework, doing your diligence, just getting your ducks in a row to make sure you have everything ready to go, well protected, well thought out, so that when it does happen, you're not scrambling,
right?
Or you're not getting ahead of yourself so that you've already done the transaction or you've got the terms in place, but then you don't have the IP to support it.
Right.
And when we talk about IP, IP is a broad term. Mm-hmm. It's used to describe any creative output of the mind, and it can involve a lot of commercial value, you know, especially when you have inventions or artistic works, product packaging, designs, and terms people recognize often, patents, trademarks, copyrights, trade secrets. All of this stuff needs to be focused on when you're coming into the market.
And on the trade secrets point, we deal with a lot of companies whose home jurisdictions don't have the equivalent of trade secrets. And so when you start discussing that with them, remind them that, you know, the Coke recipe is one of the most famous trade secrets out there. It's just additional avenues to protect their output.
Yeah. And the trade secret aspect of it kind of delves into the HR policies, labor law issues.
Employment agreements. Yep.
So it's very holistic. IP is going to touch on a little bit of everything. You want to know these things going in.
Well, yeah, audit your IP. Know what you have. Like you said, companies can be operating really, really quickly, right? The pace, it's a cliche, but it's also true, right?
5 years and they're focused on sales. And they've kind of forgotten, for example, that they invented something unique.
Right.
And they always thought, maybe we should get a patent. And they just never did.
Yeah.
And now they may have missed the opportunity and it's out there and they're getting copied and they're frustrated that they can't do anything about it.
Right. Or the worst case, there was an Irish company in the cosmetic space that had the same name as a large U.S. financial services company. And so here's your choice.
I've had over the years, so many clients come in from Europe, for example, with long established brands in the EU.
Yeah.
And they just come in and they say, this is our next natural step. US is a big market. Here we are. And we're selling, we're doing stuff. And all of a sudden they get a demand letter.
Because
somebody has a trademark that's similar and they don't like these guys, whether they're competitors or not,
right,
using the same mark and maybe causing confusion. And now all of a sudden, you know, you put the cart before the horse, everything's already out there.
Yeah.
You're scrambling, you're spending so much time trying to fix things.
Right. It's always in the fixing that the costs skyrocket. If you had just sat down at the front end, done the filing, a couple $1,000, you're fine. You had a trademark dispute, it's a much different beast.
And it works in the flip too. So we have, for example, I have a US client right now that I'm helping who have taken their products into the UK without doing the diligence, and their brands have been opposed. Potential legal action has been subtly threatened. And now we're trying to unwind everything, yeah, and fix it. And, you know, it's not fun. You're right. It's expensive. And the main thing is it takes the business people away from the business.
Right.
Now they're dealing with this headache instead of focusing on product development, driving sales and all that stuff.
I think some people at our firm would be shocked to hear me say this, but when I talk to clients about this expansion, I sometimes say to them, I don't want to spend my time talking to you. You need to be out there building the business. And, you know, if you're spending more time speaking to me, that's not great.
Unless it's for productive things.
Exactly.
You're
right.
Helping, yeah, them get into new markets, joint ventures, or whatever might be the case. That's good use of Mike's time.
That's right. Well, your time too. But then again, we always get the nasty grams, right? Of you're doing something you shouldn't be doing, we're going to sue you.
Yeah.
And stuff.
Yeah. So, and I think we were going to get into this when we talked about doing this podcast, but focusing on trademarks, you know, one of the key things any company should do before they enter the US, and especially if they know, for example, it's 2024, we have a plan to get into the market by 2025, get going on the trademark side of things. So inventory, what brands are we going to bring into the US and then engage trademark counsel like
us,
me, or,
yeah,
or whoever,
yeah,
to look at that and say, all right, what is the risk that if I bring these brands into market and try and register it with the United States Patent and Trademark Office, that I'm going to succeed and I'll be relatively low risk? Take that step early, because sometimes what you might find is, hey, three of these brands are fine, two of these are not going to work, or your main brand, there is already somebody in that space.
Right.
And you should definitely not use this.
Somebody's already using Chevrolet, believe it or not.
Believe it or not. Tesla makes cars.
Yeah.
And so if you think through that and then you get the advice back, now you have plenty of time to pivot and,
right,
say, okay, maybe for the US, we need a different brand, same stuff, but we're going to use that brand in the US and maybe other countries in that,
sure,
region. Or in some cases, if your company is new enough and you're really thinking through this strategically, you might say, we are considering this brand for our country and the US and for the UK. Let's make sure we're low risk in all three,
yeah,
before we use them anywhere. And that's the best option.
I'm about to ask you the question that we always get, which it's a question, but based off the statement that we always get, which is, we've got the marks registered in our home jurisdiction, we're fine.
No.
No, yes.
You know, so a lot of people don't realize your trademark rights are limited to where you register,
right,
them. And in countries like the US, where you use them. So there's no such thing as an international registration. I mean, there is, but it's a misnomer, because you can register with WIPO.
Right.
But it really just gives you the right to then go try and register another country.
With the reference date of when, yeah, you registered with WIPO.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, a lot of companies don't understand that step. But just remember, it's very country specific. If you're going into China, you've got to register in China.
Right.
It doesn't cover Taiwan. You've got to register in Taiwan. So keep that in mind from the outset.
I mean, again, territorial. And also, I guess, two wrinkles relevant to USPTO. One being, you have to be a US admitted lawyer to practice in front of PTO, which the Lawyer Full Employment Act is, it is kicking in. But also, if you do get into a situation of where there's alleged infringement, either way, having a U.S. filed trademark helps.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a good defensive tool, but it's a really good offensive tool if you want to clear the marketplace.
You know, that's one of the main steps. So when we were talking a moment ago, do your homework early, figure out the risk. If there is low or manageable, tolerable risk, there are steps that we might take in advance of your entry to go ahead and start getting those marks registered on the USPTO registry. So if somebody else comes up with the same idea, you can block them, or worst case situation, send them a demand letter and take action that you need to take.
Yeah. So, I mean, typically what kind of business agreements, business contracts we need to have you take a look at?
Great question. I'm just thinking of a project I just worked on for a German client, you know, technology and patent license, but they were giving a license to this company in the US. And one of the terms was talking about, well, if you're going to register the trademark in the US, you have to do all these different things. We don't take on the risk. You'll take on the risk. I mean, that's one thing, right? Complicated trademark licenses and how to structure the risk allocation.
Right.
So a lot of companies will have brands in their home country that are tied to some successful product, and some other company wants to use it in the US, let's say. But this company in the home country says, that's fine, but I don't want to take on any of the risk.
Right. Yeah. This is you.
I'm fine giving you this gadget and letting you be the sole distributor and taking our brand wherever you want to go and giving us nice royalties. But hey, if you get in a fight, you're going to pay, you're going to defend, you're going to protect us and all this stuff. And so a lot of these agreements are structured, you know, in a very sophisticated way to, again, for our client, for my client, to preserve risk and limit liability. You know, other sort of interesting situations can come up in these transactions. So if you're a foreign company, you come to US and you want to do some sort of creative project. So you hire a videographer to come into your new US factory and record all the sophisticated machinery and how it's a best in class facility. And then you pay this person or this company to do it, and you put it up on the web to showcase to your prospects. And all of a sudden, what do you get?
You get a demand letter saying, take it down. I didn't give you, me as a videographer, I didn't give you the rights to post it on the internet.
And that's because under copyright law in the US,
he creates it.
The author owns the copyright. And in your agreement, which you just signed off on the videographer's agreement without checking with one of us, the author, the videographer retained the copyright ownership. And the copyright ownership is the exclusive right to display, reproduce, share all of this
derivative work.
You know, you may have paid them $2,000 to take this nice high definition video, but that did not bring with it the right to now put it up on your website, share it in social. So these kinds of things can happen and do happen. And then to extricate yourself from it is just even more cumbersome and expensive. So from the outset, we'll work on these agreements to make sure that not only are you getting the physical video product, but then all the rights that come with it to do what you want, and also limiting the videographer from doing anything else with it because it's yours and they're just the hired help.
A deliverable in, you know, a work made for hire. As an associate writing contractor agreements, we got drilled into our heads. You put that in there. For years, you just don't think about what it means. You just want to check the box that you put it in there. But just very quickly on our copyright system, it's a little bit different than...
It is. It is. And work for hire in the
it's
US.
It's a whole other...
It is such, again, a misnomer. You think, well, if I hire somebody to do this work, it's work for hire, and the law automatically gives me ownership. It doesn't. It's by statute, and it's a very short and specific set of situations that almost never apply to companies. It's usually like in the entertainment space and literary space, but not really for companies. So we'll often see that language in there, but then we'll make sure that
that actually works. Because here there's no filing required for the copyright to exist. It pops into existence at creation.
You know, so one caveat to that is if you want to enforce your copyright in US courts, you have to get a registration first, and the registration brings with it certain advantages. So we often advise clients, if you have a work that's susceptible to being copied, photography, for example, it's not expensive. Let's go ahead and get the registration, hold it in our back pocket, because if you ever have to go after somebody, it's very powerful.
Yeah. I want to maybe pivot a little bit to advertising. We've seen a lot of recent agreements about advertising and what can I put on my label? What can I put on my packaging? And the subset of that you and I work on is, you know, when can I say made in America? And you're more like, yeah, no, just because you packaged it here, that's not enough. Right. But let's start kind of high level stuff about advertising in the US, because again, our regulations differ from, say, the EU, where in some jurisdictions, if you're advertising a product, you're limited in what you can say comparing your product to a competitor's product.
That's right. In the US, you can compare, but there's a variety of laws that may apply and industry standards. Yep. And so it's not like you can look in one place and you know what's going to happen. If you're coming into the US and you're saying, I will advertise my services or advertise my products, a lot of it is around products, some is around services. What are the watch outs or what can I look at to kind of understand what I can and can't say? And it varies from federal law and regulations, yep, laws that are created by courts, state laws, and then, like I said, industry standards, right, kind of what's acceptable in the industry you're in. And so, you know, here at AGG, our team does what's called creative review. So, for example, if a client creates a creative asset, packaging and advertising, movie clip, anything like that, we're going to look at it holistically from all of these angles and issue spot things that either create risk, need to be changed to put you in the lowest risk position.
Right.
While still letting you achieve what you want to do, yeah, with these assets. So one of the things we look at is the FTC Act. Federal Trade Commission, yep, is a U.S. federal agency that is tasked with protecting the public.
Section 5,
yeah,
of the Act.
Yeah. And their main goal is that the advertising, the product claims, all this stuff needs to be truthful and not misleading.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of the principal point that any of these laws, state laws, case-made law, there's another statute called the Lanham Act,
yeah,
in the U.S., which competitors can use to combat false advertising from a competitor, for example. That's the main point, is it can't be misleading. It has to be truthful. And what does that mean? It means a lot of different things. So you mentioned made in USA claims.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a whole body of regs and guidance around when you can say that. You know, what aspect of your product is made
has
in
to
the
be
US?
Right. And some people don't realize is the FTC version of that question differs from the US Customs version of that question. And you can have a situation where one's made in the USA, one's made in America, right? I mean, it's, yep, like, why not just have one standard, but it's the government. And,
yep,
you know.
And so you want someone in your corner who understands, yep, those sensitivities and intricacies. So you have to be mindful of that. You have to be mindful of green claims in the US.
Yes.
Because we have a lot of clients coming in, again, from Europe, from UK, yeah, because it is so popular in those regions to have environmentally friendly products and products that have an advantage for the environment, to just come in the US and start repeating those claims.
Yeah.
But again, under the FTC, under the Lanham Act, industry standards, yeah, you have to be very careful.
Yeah.
You can't make broad claims.
Right.
You have to be very specific and you have to be able to back it up.
And this is an area, I think that just this year, I've had two companies from Europe get cease and desist letters from, well, actually not a cease and desist letter. They got a nasty gram from a plaintiff's law firm saying, I bought your product and I was harmed because it wasn't.
Yeah.
And of course, luckily, both clients in this case had testing to back up what they said.
That to me is almost the bigger risk, right? That's the 800-pound gorilla in the room,
right,
which is when you come to the US and what everybody fears is the litigation, and especially the, yeah, class action.
Yes. Yeah.
Lawyers looking for the, yes, next thing to go after.
Right.
Right.
And, like, and greenwashing, as they call it, is,
yeah,
is front and center.
Yeah. I mean, saying stuff like your product's all natural, it's vegan, it's gluten-free, or with the greenwashing,
recyclable,
it's made of recycled materials,
yep,
100% recyclable. Some people slap this on because they don't know any better and start selling,
right,
until somebody calls them out on it. And if you get one of these demand letters or you get pulled into a California state court with this kind of false advertising injury
California
claim,
or New York.
Even if you don't get past the initial stages of the lawsuit and you settle, It's so expensive.
Right. I mean, again, it's money and time that could be you invest a little bit at the front end to avoid that larger investment down the road. So I tell clients, to my knowledge, nothing is out there that will immunize a company from any kind of lawsuit in the United States ever.
That's right.
And when somebody sends a putative class action, you pull from the file and say, we've got the proof. I'm warning you. And, you know, by the rule 11.
Rule 11.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sanction letter.
See, this is, I'm on the
court. Mike's going to be a litigator.
No, I think if anybody in the litigation team hears that, they're going to
send you a rule 11 letter.
Yeah. Scott's head just exploded. But speaking of litigation, what options are there? Let's say we've got, you know, an Irish company, the affiliates here, they're selling product in the US. They get a cease and desist letter. What are the options?
It's interesting. It depends on context, right? So if, Mike, you had handled this Irish company's business creation in the US and you're helping them with their contracts, maybe they're in a dispute with their vendor or distributor. You might have put in an arbitration or a mediation clause, keeping it all very confidential, very private, in a venue that's affordable for them, not California, not New York,
right?
That might be a way to handle things. Yeah. And I think the listener to this podcast is familiar because these things happen around the world.
Yeah.
But let's say it's not that. Let's say it is you going after a competitor that is falsely advertising or falsely comparing your products to theirs, and you need to take some action. Or you've gotten into a dispute, again, with a supplier, and they want to take you to court because you can't figure things out. So in the US, you have a variety of options. In any given state, you'll have state courts, and usually they will be divided at the county level.
Yeah.
So you'll have in each county different levels of state courts. And so a competitor might bring an action there. It could be for libel. It could be for breach of contract, all of these things. And then sort of running parallel with that is our federal court system. So in Atlanta, we'll have federal courts with different divisions around the Atlanta area. And in the state of Georgia, you'll have even more. And the federal courts really only hear things that either come up or arise under federal law, like the Lanham Act to deal with trademark infringement, or when the parties are from
different places
and the amount in controversies over a certain amount, it's seen as justifiable enough to invoke a federal court's jurisdiction. And as a company that wants to, again, manage risk and wants the best outcome, sometimes going to federal court is the better option, especially if you're an outsider to the U.S. and you don't want to come before a state court judge.
And we're not maligning any state. We're just saying, you don't want to get into the local courts. You want to national.
And I would say, you know, because I litigate, federal courts just see a lot more IP disputes, especially
they're better versed at it than
it's just the volume of it. So they have judges, often judges who specialize in certain types of IP.
Yeah.
So again, being in federal court to me is the better option, but you may not often have a chance to pick. So you should be mindful of these things and potential for litigation. But my goal is always to avoid getting there if we can. And so, you know, a lot of times we'll try and resolve it between the parties, if not through mediation, which is non-binding, but often getting folks together with a powerful, reasonable mediator.
And, you know, speaks to actually paying attention to the choice of law dispute resolution clauses. And then also to the extent your agreement allows for calls for injunctive relief to make sure you cut that out of, you know, going to court doesn't preclude injunctive relief.
That's right. We do as a firm handle a lot of international arbitrations.
Yeah.
So especially, for example, if it's a Dutch company or a German company, and they're coming into the US and they're entering into a sophisticated transaction with a US company, they'll often want to limit everything to arbitration and have the arbitration venue be somewhere like Singapore or the UK. And we know how to look at those deals, look at the context and advise what makes the most sense. But it is possible to completely separate yourself from the US judicial system and take the dispute elsewhere and resolve it in that way, so that whether it's the law that's applying to the arbitration or the venue, you feel is a little more objective, a little more fair, maybe a little bit more used to these cross-border disputes.
Anuj, before we stop, I'll ask you the worst question, which is final words of advice for a company that's out there potentially listening to this and they're thinking about what they need to do next. What do you tell them?
Yeah, I mean, I would say it's never too late.
Right.
So if you're already in the US and you're listening to this and you're saying, well, crap, I missed it.
What's a trademark?
Yes. It's not too late. Reach out and we can figure things out. But whether you're already here or you're looking to do your first cross-border thing soon, really, let's get a good process in place. Yeah. As I mentioned, create a review. But really, it's a review of your intangible assets at the outset, figuring out what IP you have, how to best leverage it, protect it. And my favorite thing, keep the risk low so you can do what you do and not have any headaches as you expand in the US.
Sounds great. Anuj, if one of our listeners wants to get in touch with you, how do they do that?
You can reach out to me at anuj.desai@agg.com. You can call me. I'm at 404-873-8658, or just shout out at Mike. Mike will get me involved.
Yeah, we'll forward it to you. I have no idea what they're talking about. You take this. Awesome. Well, Anuj, thank you so much for taking the time today to sit and discuss IP. You know, again, seems like we're in an IP world where it's the intangibles that drive the economy in a lot of ways. So with that, I will thank our listeners again for listening to this episode of AGG Talks Cross-Border Business. And we will be back soon. Thanks a lot.